From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Elaine Clark. 18th century philosopher Thomas Day was known for his radical views on human rights. He wrote a best-selling anti-slavery poem and refused to support America's independence as long as America kept slaves. He couldn't stand the hypocrisy. But Thomas Day kept a secret from London society. He had strange notions about his ideal woman. She had to be whip-smart, physically tough, and above all, completely subservient to him. Not surprisingly, Day wasn't very lucky with the ladies. So he went to an orphanage, selected a girl, and commenced a most bizarre educational experiment. Today, we're joined by author Wendy Moore, who tells the story in her book. It's called How to Create the Perfect Wife. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Elaine Clark, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're telling a strange story of an 18th century experiment in education conducted by the poet, philosopher, and abolitionist Thomas Day. Day was a product of the Enlightenment, a time when scholars turned to reason and science to understand the human experience. He was disgusted by the excesses and shallowness of many of his peers in polite English society. He was interested in social justice and charity. He wanted to live remotely, a simple life of intellectual pursuits and nature. And to complete the picture, he needed the ideal wife. She should be beautiful and chaste, intelligent, hardy enough to withstand a life of deprivation, and most of all, and this was very important, completely and utterly acting in deference to his desires. No small order to fill, and the gentlewomen of Georgian England weren't exactly clamoring to fill the role. So what's a guy to do? There's no online dating, a mail-order bride scheme won't work, it's a problem with Pygmalion written all over it. So Day trudges off to an orphanage and gets not one but two young girls, 11 and 12 to be precise, with a plan to create his own perfect wife. Joining us to tell the story of Thomas Day and his bizarre scheme is Wendy Moore. She's the author of How to Create the Perfect Wife, Britain's Most Ineligible Bachelor, and His Enlightened Quest to Train the Ideal Mate. We invite you to join us as well. 801-585-WEST is the number. That's 801-585-9378. You can also send email to radiowest@kuer.org or join us on Facebook and Twitter. Wendy Moore is a journalist, historian, and author of three books, all of which tell remarkable stories from 18th century England. She's joining us today from the studios of the BBC in London. Wendy Moore, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Elaine. Nice to be here.
Thanks. As I mentioned in the introduction, your books have focused on 18th century England. The Knife Man is about the pioneering surgeon John Hunter, and Wedlock is about an abusive marriage and divorce of Mary Eleanor Bowes, Countess of Strathmore. What is it about the 18th century, about this period, that interests you?
I think there are two things really about the 18th century. One is all the contrasts with today. Transport was by coach. Operations were horrific, without anaesthetic, without antiseptic. Costumes were completely over the top. But at the same time, it's the similarities, because in lots of ways, the 18th century is very similar to today. There was an obsession with celebrity. People were avid readers of the newspapers to find out the latest gossip. And there was also vast extremes of wealth and poverty. The rich would often be incredibly ostentatious about their wealth.
The story of Thomas Day's wife cultivating adventure wasn't entirely a secret. It was fictionalized and discussed in memoirs even at the time. But Day and his supporters, and certainly the girl's family, did make efforts to conceal or at least obscure the story. What drew you to this particular story, and how difficult was it to tease out?
Well, in fact, I first came across this story before I wrote my first two books. I just saw a very short summary of it in a history book, and I immediately thought it would be an incredible story if it was true. And at the time, I thought it's probably, you know, anecdotal. It probably didn't have the material to stack it up. And so when I actually found some time to look into it, I decided to try to find out if I could actually prove that it was fact and fiction. And in order to do that, I had to go to the archives of the Foundling Hospital and see if I could actually track down these girls. And in fact, in the past, there have been some earlier stories about Day and some biographies of Day. And they've really mainly focused on his good attributes and more or less skipped over the little sort of unfortunate story about his two little girls. But none of them had actually found out who the girls were or tried to tell their story. So what I really wanted to do was to see if I could tell the story from their point of view, to try to give them a voice, if you like.
So let's talk a little bit about the Day that was painted in these earlier tales of his life and his work, those good attributes, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. perhaps how he would have preferred to be remembered. He studied law. He was a writer. Talk to us for a moment about the poem, The Dying Negro. It was written anonymously with his friend John Bicknell. They had written together since school days as the knife and the fork. What was The Dying Negro, and what did it reveal about Day and his worldview?
Well, as you say, Thomas Day had lots of good points. He was a progressive. He was very political, very radical. And one of the things that he was a very strong supporter of human rights in general. He believed in greater democracy for working class people, for example. He believed in helping the poor. And he, in particular, was completely opposed to slavery. And up to that point, there had been some small attempts to counter slavery in Britain. But Thomas Day and his friend John Bicknell were the first who wrote a full-length poem to criticise what was happening. And what they did was they took a true story. It was a story of a slave who had escaped from a ship in London and had met an English servant, and they were going to marry. In fact, if they had got married, he would have then been a free man. But before he could marry, he was captured by his former master, taken back to the ship. And in fact, rather than be taken back to the plantations, he then killed himself. So that story was given a very tiny mention in a newspaper. And Thomas Day and his friend Bicknell decided to use that in order to gain sympathy for the anti-slavery cause. And so they wrote a very powerful poem which really used the emotions to try to make British people understand what it might have been like to have been this slave. And it did actually have a huge effect and turn a lot of people in support of the anti-slavery cause.
Thomas Day was really a product of the Enlightenment era. He was focused on what could be learned through rational thought and science. He, you know, as you say, a proponent of the rights of man. He wasn't religious. You describe the philosophy he aimed to live his life by as virtue. What do you mean by that? Describe that worldview for us.
Well, we have to remember he was a wealthy man. He inherited a large fortune at the age of 21. And he was a clever man too. He went to a boarding school, he went to Oxford University. And while he was at Oxford University, he went through, the teenage angst that maybe a lot of people go through, but he wanted to work out how to live his life, what to devote his life to. I mean, as a rich man, he didn't need to work, so he didn't need to worry about a profession. But he wasn't interested in a lot of the usual 18th century pursuits, you know, drinking, carousing, that sort of thing.
Again, a lot like
so
today.
He came, yes. And he came to the conclusion that he should put his money to good works. So what he wanted to do was to, I mean, he, as you said before, he detested luxury. He detested all the kind of fashions of the day. So he wanted to live a very plain, very simple life in the countryside, quite remote. And he wanted to essentially look after the poor people in the area, the peasants, and devote his money to medical and food and an education for the poor people around him.
So in this sort of worldview, describe his ideal woman.
Well, of course, to live in this remote, austere cottage, he wanted to have a helpmeet, a soulmate. And so he initially tried to find somebody who would fit this idea. And he really wanted a strange sort of hybrid of a woman, really. Mm. He wanted a woman who would be classically beautiful, like a sort of Roman or Greek god, but very simple, like a country girl. So very simple taste, simple dress, no makeup, no accessories. But she also needed to be clever, because he wanted her to be able to discuss with him the issues of the day, but obviously to defer to his superior intelligence. And at the same time, she had to be quite hardy, quite strong, because it would be a quite comfortless life. There were going to be no servants. So essentially, she would have to do all the domestic drudgery. And so he looked in the Georgian drawing rooms of the time for this strange creature. And surprise, surprise, she wasn't to be found.
So how did his ideal square away with the typical Georgian woman? Who was the typical Georgian upper-class woman?
Well, the thing is that Day came to the conclusion that it was the way girls were educated at the time, the upper-class girls were educated, that was the problem. And to some extent, I think that's quite a valid view, because girls of the time, no matter how intelligent they were basically being trained to look after a man. So they would become adept at needlework, music perhaps, and they would learn how to dance and how to dress themselves ornately and how to make small talk in conversation. So he, he was quite, uninterested and quite disgusted by this idea of a kind of fawning, fickle women who their only interests were the best dresses or them going shopping.
Well, and his complete disinterest in fashion and the modes of the day really played out in the kind of figure he cut in the best salons in in high society. Describe what he looked like. How did he appear to the people of his social strata?
Well, he was quite a comical figure. He was actually quite tall, dark, and not particularly unhandsome, although his face was covered in smallpox scars, and he walked with a stoop, he was dishevelled. He didn't want to wear the fashionable clothing of the time, and so he would wear dowdy, old-fashioned clothes, which were quite frequently crumpled and unwashed. Instead of wearing the usual Georgian wig of the time, he liked to wear his hair loose and unwashed again, so it would be hanging lank and greasy. And to top all that, he also had quite poor social manners. So his table manners was meant to be quite crude. He had no time for the usual sort of polite conversation of the day. So he liked to either sit there silently nursing his water and his bread, or else launch into great long monologues in which he would come up with his views, his very strong views of the time.
And it's not that he wasn't considered by any of the women around him. I mean, he was wealthy, he was respected, and he did have a number of engagements. I mean, he did try his hand at all of this. You paint great portraits and wonderful characters of some of the women, and I'm going to skip to a later one because it's such a nice, concise story. Tell the story of Elizabeth Hall. She was the niece of Dr. Erasmus Darwin, Charles Darwin's grandfather. She and Day were engaged, but the story of the breakup is kind of very revealing.
Well, as you say, I mean, he perhaps surprisingly did have quite a few women followers. There were several women who considered him and then turned him down for particular reasons. Elizabeth Hall was one of the women who agreed that she would actually marry him and became engaged to him. But then he would always put down very stringent conditions about marriage, about the woman, how his future wife would dress, what she would, how she would conduct herself. And in particular, he took exception to her diamond earrings. And these weren't just actually fashionable accoutrements. They were heirlooms, family heirlooms. They'd been given to her by her grandmother, so they had sentimental value. But at any rate, she agreed that she would not wear them. So to sort of fit in with his view, she accepted that she would not wear them. But that was still not good enough. She had to actually get rid of them, according to Day. And that she refused to do. And that was the end of that marriage. So another one went down the pan.
Yeah, another one. We have to take a quick break, but when we get back, we're going to talk about how all these ideals and expectations played out in the lives of two young orphan girls. Wendy Moore is the author of How to Create the Perfect Wife, Britain's Most Ineligible Bachelor, and His Enlightened Quest to Train the Ideal Mate. You can join with your own questions. Call us at 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. You can also send emails to radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Elaine Clark, filling in for Doug Fabrizio, who's on vacation. Thomas Day was a poet and philosopher of the Enlightenment. He was wealthy and traveled in all the right circles in 18th century England, even if he was ill-mannered, pox-scarred, and purposefully unfashionable. He also had some strange ideas about his ideal mate. So when he wasn't able to find a wife through conventional means, he hatched a plan to raise one himself. Our guest today is author and historian Wendy Moore, whose new book chronicles Day's scheme to turn an orphan girl into his soulmate. The book is called How to Create the Perfect Wife. So Thomas Day, as you say, decides the problem can't be here. It's obviously the way it's obviously the way women were raised and educated. So his logical conclusion is the only thing he can do is start from scratch. So he and his friend John Bicknell, who he had co-authored that poem we talked about earlier, The Dying Negro, traveled to a branch of the Foundling Hospital. It was an organization that in this four-year period took in nearly 15,000 babies whose families couldn't care for them. Tell us a little bit about the Foundling Hospital. What was it? What was it intended to do?
Well, the Foundling Hospital was a fantastic institution, an example of real Georgian philanthropy. It was set up by a sea captain who, in fact, had himself been quite poor but had made a fortune in America. And then he came back to London and was horrified to see on his way into town abandoned babies, dead babies, being left in the streets. And so he spent many, many years raising funds and raising a consciousness in order to set up a refuge for these babies. And finally, he did that. He got the support of the royal family and the aristocracy and opened a foundling hospital. It was called an orphanage for abandoned babies. In actual fact, most of the babies were not orphans. They were illegitimate children whose mothers were too poor or too ashamed or too young to look after them. And in addition, a sizable proportion were the children of married couples, but who could not afford to feed another mouth. So over the years, the charity took in, as you say, thousands of babies. And then at one point, it was getting overwhelmed by the numbers of babies being deposited at the gates and appealed to the government for financial help. But that came with a price, that funding, because the government then insisted that it had to accept every single child brought to it. And as you say, over the next 4 years, a total of 15,000 babies were brought to its gates.
What could a girl who was raised there, or perhaps better said, raised in the system, expect of her life? What was she in for?
I mean, it was a very paternalistic, very kindly organisation. The children were educated, they were clothed, they were fed, not to any excess, but they were treated kindly by the governors, and they were brought up basically to find jobs at the age of 11 or 12, so they would be apprenticed into a reputable profession. So for the boys, that would be a trade, such as blacksmith or agricultural labourer. Most of the girls were apprenticed into service, so they became servants.
So Thomas Day's plan, was it acceptable in society? Was it legal?
Absolutely not, no. In fact, the governors took great care of the orphans, and they were very careful that orphans were not apprenticed to unmarried men. They were also very careful to make sure that they went to good homes, that there was no hint of any unseemliness, and they would actually take action against people who abused the orphans when they took them on as apprentices. So Thomas Day went about his mission with complete subterfuge. He basically turned up at one of the orphanages in Shrewsbury, near to the border of Wales, and he told the governors that he and his friend Bicknell wanted to take a young girl to become an apprentice maid for their married friend, who was called Richard Lovell Edgeworth. And I think because these two young men were wealthy, well-spoken, well-dressed, the governors simply thought, well, that must be okay. And so they actually invited the two men to choose a girl from a lineup of these young orphans.
So enter Anne Kingston. Introduce us to this young girl, 12 years old.
Well, in this lineup, the girls were identically dressed. It looked pretty much the same, all ages 11 and 12, more or less. And Thomas Day was completely overwhelmed by the choice. And so, in fact, he let his friend John Bicknell choose the girl. And she's described as being very pretty. She had coppery, curly hair, very slender. And particularly important, she was quite very sort of meek and very submissive and also quite bright. And so, in fact, in my research, I went to try to see if I could find her in the archives of the Foundling Hospital. And I was absolutely delighted when I found her original records. So because the governors kept these meticulous records on all the children, I could track her down to the day that she was actually brought to the orphanage by, we don't know who, it may have been a mother or a parish official, but it's very likely that she was actually an orphan. It seems that she probably came from a workhouse, and she arrived at the orphanage. She was only a few months or possibly even a few weeks or a few days old at the time.
So he redubs her Sabrina. He takes her to London and begins lessons immediately. But he's still really suspicious of women. He's still very mistrustful. So he figures what he needs is a spare girl. He picks up another girl from the same organization, a Dorcas Carr, who he rechristens Lucretia. Talk for a moment about this these name change. So now we have Sabrina the elder and Lucretia. Was this name change strategic? Was it a way of hiding the girls? Or was it simply a part of his plan to reinvent them?
I think it was a bit of both, actually. It made a lot of sense for him to give them new names because, quite clearly, once he'd taken these two girls out of the orphanage, they could not be found again if they were renamed. But he was also, he had a sort of romanticism, I think. He named Sabrina after the River Severn, which ran past the orphanage where she came from, the Latin name for the River Severn. And he called her surname Sidney after his one of his heroes, Sir Philip Sidney, from the Elizabethan age. Lucretia, it's not clear why he chose that name. It's quite a strange name. I don't think he was thinking of the Borgia girl, Lucretia Borgia, who
not
murdered
his ideal.
Several people. Probably not. More likely to be, I think, the Lucretia, a Roman daughter who was actually raped, and it was her rape that began the fight to establish the Republic of Rome. But I think it was basically, it was a it was a way of stamping his authority on these two girls. You know, he'd renamed them and he would now remake them.
So let's get into a little bit of the nuts and bolts of his plan. He was heavily influenced by a book, a banned book in many countries, by the French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau. It's Emile, or On Education. It was published in 1762. Explain Rousseau's plan for educating boys, we should say, for educating boys. Mm-hmm.
I mean, Rousseau, I think, is an absolutely fascinating character and a brilliant writer. He wrote several books in a very short period, which really changed world history. And one of those books was his book, Emile, On Education. And he wrote Emile in the form of a novel, but he basically describes an ideal education. And that education was revolutionary for its time. He believed that children should learn naturally at their own pace. So he didn't believe children should be put into classrooms, sat down at desks and forced to recite information off a blackboard or learn material by rote. He believed that nature should be their teacher. So they would be taken out to the woods and they would become lost, and then they would find their way home by following the stars, or they would learn about science by doing experiments. So essentially they would progress at their own natural pace. It was a very child-centred education, which, you know, we all still benefit from today, I think.
But Rousseau did not see his plan extending to girls, which is where Day's outlook actually gets a bit complicated. He thinks women could be just as intelligent as men, given the right education, of course, yet he won't extend his ideas on the rights of man to women. Talk about how he sort of created this hybrid and applied this this education scheme to Sabrina and Lucretia.
Well, Rousseau also believed that women were potentially equally intelligent to men. However, in the real world, in the 18th century, women's role was to be subservient to men. So essentially, they were being bred to marry and to look after their man, to cook, to have children. Rousseau's education for girls was completely different to his education for boys. He believed that girls could should play with dolls, that they might learn to read and to write a little bit and do a little bit of arithmetic, but essentially they should be taught to do whatever a male authority figure told them to do. So he would, for example, get them to carry out fairly pointless tasks, but which they would have to drop as soon as they were told to do so. Thomas Day really basically took the same view. I mean, he believed that women could potentially be as intelligent as men, but of course he wanted a woman who would always defer to him. And so the Rousseau idea was perfect for him. But in fact, like most parents who followed the Rousseau ideas, and many, many parents across Europe slavishly followed his ideas, most of them used the education that Rousseau had outlined for boys in order to educate both boys and girls. So in actual fact, I think most of the girls did benefit from a better education than they might have done otherwise.
There's no evidence of sexual impropriety between Day and the girls. He seemed pretty intent on an honorable relationship with them. In fact, he signed a contract, not a contract that the girls knew anything about. They were completely in the dark about all this scheming. But it was drawn up by Bicknell. Describe what he pledged to do for Lucretia and Sabrina.
Yeah, I think on the whole, his motives were largely honourable. He agreed a contract with Bicknell, who in fact was a lawyer, that he would, within 12 months, he would choose the best girl, the girl who performed best. And the one who failed that test, he would then apprentice her with a large dowry, a large amount of money, into a reputable trade. So she would be fine. The girl that he chose to be his future wife, he actually stipulated that he would not take any sexual advantage of her. And as far as I can make out, he kept to that contract. However, in a sense, it didn't matter because he took He took both girls to France, where he lived with them together, causing complete scandal. And later he settled on Sabrina as his perfect future bride and lived with her alone in a city in the middle of England. And whether or not he actually took advantage of her, her reputation was smeared forever simply by living with this man.
A quick email before we go to another break. Ryan sends this from Alexandria, Virginia, actually. He says, besides the interesting true story, there's a number of examples. It's a common theme in literature over hundreds of years. Taming of the Shrew, Pygmalion, My Fair Lady, all variations on these themes. He asks, is there something fundamentally different in the way these ultimately futile efforts are portrayed in literature than from Day's own story, the own real life version of it?
Yes, that's a very interesting question, because I think everyone in the 18th century was very aware of Pygmalion, the Roman, the poem by the Roman poet Ovid, who is about a sculptor who created his statue of a perfect woman, and then he begged the goddess Venus to bring her to life. Lo and behold, she did come to life. And I think Day, as much as any other Georgian man, was probably influenced by that story, that romantic story. So in many ways, that's what he wanted. He wanted to bring to life this perfect woman. It's also quite a timeless story, because as your listener says, there have been quite a lot of other fictional descriptions of the story. In fact, there were at least two novels in the 19th century, one by Anthony Trollope and one by Henry James, which describe a very similar story. In fact, so similar to what Thomas Day did that it's almost definitely based on what he did. So, and I think it's quite feasible that then George Bernard Shaw, when he came to write his play Pygmalion, which of course then became the musical and the film My Fair Lady, I think it's quite possible that he was influenced at least by those novels, if not by hearing the story of Day himself.
Author and historian Wendy Moore, her book is called How to Create the Perfect Wife, Britain's Most Ineligible Bachelor and His Enlightened Quest to Train the Ideal Mate. You can join us. Our number is 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. Or email us at radiowest@kuer.org. We have to take another break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Elaine Clark, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're telling the strange story of an 18th century experiment in education. Our guest is Wendy Moore, author of the book How to Create the Perfect Wife, Britain's Most Ineligible Bachelor and His Enlightened Quest to Train the Ideal Mate. Thomas Day had taken on two orphans in an attempt to mold the perfect wife for himself. At this point in our story, he's decided that Lucretia is, in the words of his friend Richard Edgeworth, invincibly stupid. He's packed her off to an apprenticeship, leaving him with only Sabrina, the girl he's convinced he will teach to be his wife. So they head back to England from France, and things get, if this is even possible, even weirder. He really ups the game on Sabrina and starts to introduce these physical tests to her educational regime. Give us some examples of what he was putting her through.
Well, that's right. I mean, he was still following the Rousseau idea. So he taught her to write. He taught her to agree with his ideas. He was getting her to do all the domestic drudgery in the house. But there was also a hard side to the Rousseau theory, as well as the kind of soft, natural education. Because Rousseau believed that children should be inured to extremes of pain and climate and hardship. And Day followed this to the letter. So he would dunk Sabrina in the lake and then force her to up to her neck into the water, and then she had to get out and lie in the meadow until she dried. He would stick pins in her flesh, and he would drop hot sealing wax on her shoulders and her back. And throughout all this, of course, she was not supposed to make a noise or flinch. Perhaps the most horrific thing of all, he would fire a pistol at her skirts. And again, she was supposed to stand there completely passively while he shot at her. In actual fact, she supposedly managed to pass all these tests. But she was by this point getting rather fed up of all the domestic drudgery that he was forcing upon her.
Was it the domestic drudgery that was more worthy of being fed up with as opposed to these tests?
Well, I think she kind of thought that she could prove herself, and she was she later would actually apparently say that yes, you know, I'd managed to do all these things. But at any rate, he decided that she wasn't quite slavishly agreeing with everything he wanted to do, and so after a year of these trials, he decided that he would put her in a boarding school for the time being, and then he proceeded to try to find a wife by more conventional methods.
So he had set up his house in Litchfield, where he was surrounded by intellectuals like Dr. Erasmus Darwin, yeah, which we mentioned earlier, the poet Anna Seward. Did they know what was going on, and what did they make of it?
They certainly did. He made no real secret of what he was trying to do in Litchfield. It was a very small society. Everyone knew what was going on. He took Sabrina to meet his friends. So she was a regular at Erasmus Darwin's house and Anna Seward's house. And by all accounts, they welcomed her, and she became good friends with them. They obviously thought that Day was quite eccentric, and they were quite concerned about what he was doing, but more for his reputation than for the girl's reputation. Hmm. They did try to discourage him and subvert what he was trying to do. But I think because he was rich, because he was well-spoken, because he was quite radical, nobody tried to stop him doing what he was doing.
So as you mentioned, he packs her off to boarding school and is trying to find another wife, but he's always still got her kind of strung along in the background. Not that he was interacting with her, but he had her waiting in the wings. Just in case. So she does 3 years at school and then enters an apprenticeship with a dressmaker. And then suddenly Day gets a March hare that it's really time for him to get married. Seriously now. And he brings her back. She's, I think, 21. And he's still inventing these bizarre trials to test her. And she's pretty much had it. What's the final breaking point between the two of them, Sabrina and Thomas Day?
Well, it's slightly unclear, but according to his friends, he was actually on the point of marrying her. So he decided that this second attempt at her education was going very well. She was doing everything she was told to do. But at that point, he left her with one of his friends. He went to London and he came back. He'd apparently told her before he left that she had to wear her clothes in a certain manner, which was the way he usually sort of spoke to her. And he came back, and to his horror, she had been wearing her dress in the way that he didn't like. And it was supposedly that then made him drop her completely, and he never saw her again. But I think there's possibly more to it than that. That
one
just sounds
think
to me quite implausible. I think by that point he'd actually met the woman who would in fact become his perfect wife.
Love wasn't really ever part of his equation. I mean, it may have been romantic ideals and poetry and literature, but he wrote, "Love, I am firmly convinced, is the effect of prejudice and imagination. A rational mind is incapable of it, at least in any great degree." And yet, as you say, he finds somebody who falls madly in love with him. So he introduces to Esther Milnes, and
Well, incredible as it might seem, Day actually did find a woman who, from every possible angle, was clearly his perfect wife. Esther Milnes, she was actually an heiress, so she was quite wealthy. She'd been very well educated. She was very clever. She'd write poetry herself. Very talented. She was supposed to be very good at the harpsichord, and quite prim and proper. So in many ways, she was very like him, a kind of mirror image of him, I think. And as soon as she met him, she knew he was her perfect partner. I think she was really kind of, she agreed with his radical views. She was very moved by his poem about against slavery. And I think she saw something of the unworldly poet in him, really. But it took him a long time to recognise that she plainly was besotted with him and obviously clearly was the woman of his dreams. So it was 3 years before he actually asked her to marry him.
And so they did marry, to say the least. It was hardly idyllic. Their life mm-hmm. was austere. He had forced her to quit writing. And she would even go through these stages when she would get frustrated and leave yeah. him for a brief period. But then she'd write and beg his forgiveness and return.
Yes.
What was she getting out of this marriage, out of this relationship?
It's quite hard to know in lots of ways. you would imagine it would be the perfect marriage because she was quite happy to live with him in this remote farm, doing good works, looking after his every need. She agreed to give up her harpsichord, to stop her poetry, to give up all her friends. But even that wasn't enough for him. The secret is that Day had this vision of the perfect wife and he would never be satisfied. Mm. He always wanted perfection. So however incredible Esther might be, he was always trying to chip away a little bit more at her self-esteem, try to correct her. And so, as you say, there were arguments when she would fight against his regime, but she would always give in and come back to him and beg forgiveness.
Here's a sort of abrupt end to Day's story. I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say that he dies, somebody who lived mm-hmm. quite so long ago. But he's thrown from his horse, and many of his contemporaries see the irony in this because he was this great believer in animal rights and, frankly, hadn't trained his horse very well. What do you make of that story?
Well, he, as you say, he believed animals should be treated kindly. He was a vegetarian for some time and was opposed to hunting. And so rather than break in his horses by the conventional method, which was brute force, basically, he had decided to go for a gentle coaxing for his horse in the manner of Rousseau, I suppose. And whether or not it was for that reason, the horse threw him and he never survived. He died on the spot.
So Sabrina, all this time, was getting a small living allowance from Day, and mm-hmm. she was still yeah. accepted in Litchfield's social circles, and she was getting marriage proposals.
Yes, exactly. And she would consult him and he would be quite unhelpful and discourage her from various marriage proposals. But she did eventually marry. She was 28 and the man she married was, in fact, the friend of Thomas Day, John Bicknell, who had originally chosen her from the Foundling Hospital. But it was a short-lived marriage because he was by that time a kind of down at heel, quite ill, hugely in debt, really sort of not particularly reputable lawyer who got huge gambling debts. So I don't know whether he was more attracted by Sabrina or by the large amount of money that Day had agreed to pay her. So the marriage only lasted for 3 years, in fact. And
so
then he died.
Sabrina learned for the first time of Day's original scheme, when she was courting or married to John Bicknell, mm-hmm. she had thought all along that she had just been apprenticed to be a housemaid, and he mm-hmm. sort of later landed upon this idea of marriage. Mm-hmm. How did she react to learning that this was his plan all along?
Yeah, she was horrified. She'd not suspected at all. As you say, she thought she was being educated out of his goodwill to become his housekeeper. And so she wrote to him and demanded to know the truth. And then he wrote this letter, quite incredible, long letter, which was completely intended to justify what he'd done. And he argued that basically whatever had happened to her in the end, he had always done what was best for her by simply taking her out of the Foundling Hospital and educating her. She would always have been better off than if he'd left her there. But he basically was completely remorseless about it.
She eventually landed a respectable job as a housekeeper and secretary at a boys' school and influenced many young men. And she was treated with respect. You say she died well-loved and a well-off Victorian matron. I mean, I guess it leads us right to that. What he argued, that she was better off. Was she better off for Day's interference? What would her life have been like if he hadn't picked her out that day when she was 12?
I think it's quite probable that she was better off, actually. It's possible that she would have gone into service or even been sent to the mills of the north and had a kind of short and unhappy life. So she almost certainly was better off. And she made very good friends. Most of Day's friends actually remained friends with her and looked after her. In particular, Richard Lovell Edgeworth was a lifelong friend and sent her money. And she did live a good life in the end. She became, but through her own means, essentially, in the end, after he discarded her, she did. She worked for a while as a maid in order to make a living to look after her two young sons. And she was, by all accounts, an extremely efficient housekeeper. So it's hard to know to what extent it was the education he gave her that made her what she was, or nature nurture. Was it her natural personality? We'll never know.
Well, nature versus nurture was an intellectual debate of the period. The education didn't work on Sabrina as far as Thomas Day was concerned, but her life was certainly changed by the Foundling Hospital, by Day's bizarre scheme, by boarding school. And an interesting side story, during one of Day's courtships, a woman had agreed to marry him if he would go off and sort of improve his social skills a little bit, maybe dress a little better, which, I mean, he went off to France, and needless to say, he made an effort, but he kind of came back maybe even more ridiculous than when he left.
I thought that was the most fascinating and most humorous aspect of the whole story, actually, that having himself tried to groom this girl to become his perfect wife, he actually submitted to be groomed to become this woman's idea of the perfect husband. But as you say, he became a laughing stock.
What did you learn about that relationship between these two forces, do you think, about nature and nurture in the course of exploring these stories?
Well, it's very difficult to know because we don't actually know her original nature. We don't know who her parents were. But perhaps they were aristocrats, or perhaps they were homeless and incredibly poor. We just don't know. But I think she's a very clear example of how education is absolutely crucial, because it was through the Foundling Hospital that she had a great education. She learnt to read and to do simple sums. Through Day, she learnt to write and to absorb a lot of his information. And through boarding school, she also acquired a lot of the typical attributes of young ladies of the day. So she was described in later life as being, a very pleasant, very, very confident, very intelligent, and very likable person. So I think, on the whole, I think probably nurture won over in this case.
Sabrina Bicknell was horrified, obviously, by the idea of her past coming out, not just because of what happened with Thomas Day, but also because if it was found out that she was from the Foundling Hospital, it would be clear that she was illegitimate. So she was terrified, as one journal put it, of becoming tea table tittle-tattle. Georgians, as you mentioned earlier, like their gossip. Not, of course, unlike we do today, but why do you think this story's still being told? I mean, today we're titillated by gossip, but, you know, it's celebrity, it's people we know, and this story is still so fascinating.
I think because it's really a timeless story. It's about how perhaps we all have this vision of the perfect mate, the perfect person we want to find, or perhaps we want to change the person we know to become this vision. You know, today there are internet sites that offer to find the perfect person, even to use genetic testing or mathematical algorithms to match people up with their ideal partner. I think it's just an essential, fundamental human desire. But for most people, unlike Thomas Day, we do realise we have to compromise, and the perfect creature of our dreams does not exist. We cannot. It's pointless to pursue perfection. But I think if you're lucky, you may well find somebody to whom you are just perfectly matched.
You know, it sort of brings us back around to some of the literature and the way this story has played out in literature over time. And I was really interested in Shaw's Pygmalion, because that story ends differently than the movie that I think most of us are familiar with, My Fair Lady. Explain the difference in those endings and what you think it is that we want to see in the endings of these love stories, if you will. That might be inappropriate to call it a love story, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. In Pygmalion, he depicted a very arrogant, upper-class man who tried to train a girl, a street girl, to become a duchess, basically. There wasn't initially any intention of marrying her at all. He wanted her to pass muster in the Edwardian drawing rooms, essentially, which he proved that he could do. And in the original play, it turned out that Eliza went off on her own and became independent and set up her own flower shop. So that really subverted the myth, the original Pygmalion myth. But when it came to the film and the musical My Fair Lady, the producers were adamant that it had to have a happy ending. And so they then introduced the implication. It's not spelled out absolutely, but the implication that Professor Higgins and Eliza Doolittle end up as an item. So I think it's a kind of fundamental desire for romance, really, isn't it?
I suppose so, for hundreds of years, as we see. Journalist and historian Wendy Moore. Her book is called How to Create the Perfect Wife, Britain's Most Ineligible Bachelor and His Enlightened Quest to Train the Ideal Mate. She joined us today from the BBC in London. And I have to say, there are so many stories that we didn't get to, so many great characters. It's a terrific book. You should check it out. Wendy Moore, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Elaine. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. The show is produced by myself and Benjamin Bombard. Our executive producer is, of course, Doug Fabrizio. We'll be back next week. I'm Elaine Clark.